I'm going to try to pick out some other people. In fact, I would like some help. I'm going to give some assignments tonight. Chuck, you going to be here next week? On Wednesday? I'm talking to you, Chuck. Pastor Chuck. Lord willing. Now, here's your assignment. I want you to find and give us a 3-minute to 4-minute report on somebody that's not so well known, but who had a big impact on, and I'm going to give you an example of it right here in just a minute, a big impact on our world, our society, or our nation. It doesn't have to be something from the Bible or anything. It could be a Christian, but I'm just saying somebody that's not so well known that will give a, that, and you tell us who that is, and you be ready to give a report next week on that, all right? 3 to 5 minutes. 3 to 5 minutes. Okay, but well, I'll just come tackle you if you go too long. As sure as I say that, Aaron's going to tackle me on Sunday when I go too long. But okay, so 3 to 5 minutes, all right? Let's see. Brother Donovan, I see you sitting right there. All right? I want you to find a little, and I know you've been a pastor and everything. I know you can do this. You find somebody, give me 3 to 5 minutes the next week, all right, on somebody that is not so well known in our history, but who had a big impact. Now, don't let it be Eli Whitney and the cotton gin or something, or Robert Fulton and the steam engine, okay? I'm not looking for they're too well known. Somebody not so well known. So let me ask you, how many of you here know Eliza Skidmore? I bet you've been influenced by Eliza Skidmore, whether you know it or not. I doubted that you would know her, but a lot of us have enjoyed the fruit of her tireless efforts. Let me tell you a little bit about her. This lady was a travel writer and a photographer that made a huge difference in what you see when you go to Washington, D.C., our nation's capital. Neither travel writers nor photographers were very much in vogue at the time she was doing what she was doing. This was 1885. In 1885, she was fresh off of a trip from Japan, and she had a satchel. How many of you remember the word satchel? When I went to school, I had to carry a satchel, and it had all of my books and all that stuff. I had my lunch in one side. I'm an old guy, though. So, anyway, she had a satchel full of pictures and drawings of Japanese cherry trees. She came to Washington with a single focus. She came to Washington with a desire to beautify our nation's capital by planting Japanese cherry trees. She began her assault on the White House in that year of 1885, and it took 24 years for her to get anyone to listen to her. In 1912, Helen Taft, the wife of the president, listened to her suggestions and became her champion to try to get cherry trees planted. And so in the year 1912, 3,000 Japanese cherry trees and their beautiful blossoms. How many of you ever seen them? I've been there. Some of the most beautiful trees in the world. She, along with Helen Taft, were the ones that were responsible for planting 3,000 of those trees. They're still blooming. They've been planted and replanted, transplanted many times. Generations have enjoyed their beauty. And it all started because one person said that Washington, D.C. is too drab, and that we need to do something to beautify the place. And that's what she did. Japanese cherry trees. So she's somebody that's very, very, not very well known, but she had a pretty big impact. In fact, those cherry trees are famous world over. Now we're going to look at somebody in the Bible tonight that's little known that made a huge impact. We're going to talk about a lady, and her name is J.L., and I call her J.L. the Assassin. You're going to say, wait a minute, you're going to talk to us tonight about an assassin? Yeah, just let me get into it, okay? So this is kind of interesting. The book of Joshua closed with a prediction and a warning from Joshua to the children of Israel. He told them, back in chapter 24, he said, now look, I want you to choose you this day whom you will serve. How many of you have that on a plaque, or you've seen it on a plaque somewhere? Choose you this day whom you will serve, the gods in Egypt, or the gods you had on the other side of the Jordan, or God. You know, as for me and my house, we will what? Serve the Lord. And so he made that challenge to them. And so the people listened to him. They promised that they would serve the God that brought them out of Egypt and made them successful in conquering Canaan. Joshua said back to them, basically, you are dreaming. This is in Joshua chapter 24, verse 14 to 28. Now, we're not going to go there. I want you to turn to Judges chapter 5. And so he said to them, you've always made big promises of obedience and you turned around and broke your promises. They did it repeatedly in the book of Judges that we're going to look at. Now, we're going to look at the story where women are the heroines and men are anything but courageous in the story. So in order to do that, you need to go to the book of Judges, and we're going to see the end before the beginning because it works better. So I want you to look at Judges chapter 5, and we're just going to kind of read through the chapter, and then I'm going to go back and make a few comments about it. And let's see, Joshua, Judges. I can't even find Judges in my Bible. It's been cut out. There it is right there. Okay, so we're going to do a little reading tonight. I want you to just watch this. We're talking about little-known people with tremendous impacts. And here is a person. She might have an impact from a negative point of view, but she certainly did make an impact. So listen to me now. I'm going to read this passage, and you follow along, and we're going to go back and look at it. So then Deborah and Barak, the son of Ahinoam, sang on that day, saying that the leaders led in Israel, that the people volunteered. Bless the Lord. Hear, O kings, give ear, O rulers, to the Lord I will sing. I will sing praise to the Lord, to God of Israel. Lord, when thou didst go out from Seir, when thou didst march from the field of Edom, the earth quaked and the heavens also dripped. Even the clouds dripped water. The mountains quaked at the presence of the Lord. This Sinai at the presence of the Lord, the God of Israel. In the days of Shamgar, the son of Anath, in the days of Jael, the highways were deserted, and travelers went by roundabout ways. The peasantry ceased, and they ceased in Israel until I, Deborah, arose, until I arose, a mother in Israel. New gods were chosen. Then war was in the gates. Not a shield or a spear was seen among 40,000 in Israel. That is a very key verse right there. Not a shield or a spear was seen among 40,000 in Israel. My heart goes out to the commanders of Israel, the volunteers among the people. Bless the Lord. You who ride on white donkeys, you who sit on rich carpets, and you who travel on the road, sing at the sound of those who divide the flocks among the watering places. There they recount the righteous deeds of the Lord, the righteous deeds for his peasantry in Israel. Then the people of the Lord went down to the gates. Awake, awake, Deborah, awake, awake, sing a song. Arise, Barak, and take away your captives, O son of Abinoam. Then survivors came down to the nobles. The people of the Lord came down to me as warriors from Ephraim. Those whose root is in Amalek came down, following you, Benjamin, with your peoples. From Maker, commanders came down, and from Zebulun, those who wield the staff of office. And the princes of Issachar were with Deborah. As was Issachar, so was Barak. Into the valley they rushed at his heels. Among the divisions of Reuben, there were great resolves of heart. Why did you sit among the sheepfolds? To hear the piping for the flocks? Among the divisions of Reuben, there was great searchings of the heart. Gilead remained across the Jordan. And why did Dan stay in ships? Asher sat at the seashore and remained by its landing. Zebulun was a people who despised their lives even unto death. And Naphtali also on the high places of the fields. The kings came and fought. Then fought the kings of Canaan at Taanach near the waters of Megiddo. They took no plunder in silver. The stars fought from heaven. From their courses they fought against Sisera. The torrent of Kishon swept them away. The ancient torrent, the torrent Kishon. O my soul, march on with strength. Then the horse's hooves beat from the dashing of his valiant steeds. Curse Meraz, says the angel of the Lord. Utterly curse its inhabitants because they did not come to the help of the Lord against the warriors. Most blessed of women is Jael, the wife of Eber the Kenite. Most blessed is she of women in the tent. He asked her for water and she gave him milk. In a magnificent bowl she brought him curds. She reached out her hand for the tent peg, her right hand for the workman's hammer. Then she struck Sisera. She smashed his head. She shattered and pierced his temple. Between her feet he bowed and fell. He lay. Between her feet he bowed, he fell. Where he bowed, there he fell dead. Out of the window she looked and lamented, the mother of Sisera, through the lattice. Why does his chariot delay in coming? Why do the hoofbeats of his chariot tarry? Her wise princesses would answer her. Indeed, she repeats her words to herself. Are they not finding? Are they not dividing the spoil? A maiden to maidens for every warrior. To Sisera, a spoil of dyed work, a spoil of dyed work embroidered. Dyed work of double embroidery on the neck of the spoiler. Thus let all the enemies perish, O Lord, but let those who love him be like the rising of the sun and its might. And the land was undisturbed for 40 years. Now that's a poem or a song that was written, that was sung after this victory. So I want you to look at that song for a minute. First of all, look and notice the people. First of all, verse 1, the leaders, Deborah, a judge, and Barak, a commander, sang a song of the deliverance of evil. And then notice the facts in verse 2. When leaders stand up, people will follow. You always know who a leader is because he's the one out in front of the people that are following him. In other words, he's the leader. This is always true. When true leadership shows up, people follow. Number 3, write this, the truth. Notice the truth. The truth is God is the hero of every story in the Bible. Every story is God's story. And you know, we got to be careful about making David the story, the hero in David and Goliath. God's the hero in David and Goliath's story. David was just a young man and he had a sling and a little rock. God guided the rock. God killed Goliath for David. And here's the, God is the hero of the story. He defeated a superior army. How did he do it? He sent rains and floods and he made the river Kishon overflowed. And this bunch of these people from Jabin, this commander Sisera had 900 iron chariots. How well do you think that did out there with the floodwaters running? This is what God did to them. Verses 6 to 9, the state of the nation. Make sure you notice this. In the days of the judges, and some are mentioned here, it was not safe to travel the roads. It says there very clearly. It says the travelers went in roundabout ways. The highways were deserted because these Canaanites, King Jabin, they were just running ransack over the land. They were stealing everything, killing everybody, anybody that stuck their head up. It was a terrible, terrible time in the nation. So it wasn't safe to travel. Villages were ransacked by the enemies of the people. But instead of turning to God, they turned to the gods of Canaan. It says so there in that verse. It says new gods were chosen in verse 8. Then war was in the gates. In other words, instead of turning to the God of Israel, they turned to new gods. Well, God, you hadn't done anything for us. We'll try another one. That's what they did. And so some people are like that today. I can't help but be amazed even today to see businessmen in New York and Chicago bowing in the mosques. They used to be something else, but now they're putting up mosques and you see businessmen bowing down along with the Muslims because they don't want to be seen as fighting against the cultural moves. It's amazing. Verses 9 to 18, in the hour of struggle, here's what we found. Verses 9 to 18, this is what Deborah is talking about. Verse 9 to 11, people far from the fray, those who ride on white donkeys, usually those are the rulers, they have a lot to say, but they have little to add. They're not helping. They're just standing back talking about the problems. They do rejoice at the deliverance, but they will be the first to return to their wicked ways. I call those the people in the grandstand. And then you have people who are valiant, people who are very bold. You have Naphtali and Zebulun and Issachar. By the way, those three places, Naphtali, Zebulun, and Issachar were the ones that first saw the great light. The area north and northwest of Galilee, that was where Jesus came and did all of his miracles. Do you think it had anything to do with these people when they were the most unlikely? They were the ones that were the smallest of the tribes. They were the ones that were the most backwater. They were the ones that answered the call to stand up for the country. Amazing. So Naphtali, Zebulun, and Issachar answered the call to defend the nation. Ephraim, Benjamin, they sent a few. It was Zebulun and Naphtali that came out in mass and they risked their lives. Few answer the call to stand strong against the enemies of God, and even fewer are ready to put their lives on the line. It's specifically said that they risk their lives. Then there's the cautious. What? Look at it, if you would, what Reuben what Reuben did. It says here, into the valley rushed at his heels. Among the divisions of Reuben, there were great resolves of the heart. And then verse 16, why did you sit among the sheepfolds? To hear the piping for the flocks? Among the divisions of Reuben, there was great searchings of the heart. They were, they got hung up in committee meetings. They didn't know how to get anything done because they were in committee meetings. They were having all kinds of discussions, and they were searching their hearts, and they were trying to figure out what to do. They didn't know what to do, and they just sat back, and they didn't go, and they didn't help. Then there were the indifferent. You had the cautious. So you had the people in the grandstand just, you know, watching. You had the valiant. They did everything. They risked their lives. You had the cautious. That's Reuben. He stood back. You had the indifferent, Gilead. When you say Gilead in the scriptures, you're talking mainly about two and about one and a half tribes. You're talking about the tribe of Gad and Manasseh. Do you guys remember what happened when the children of Israel were coming to go into Jordan? What Gad and half the tribe of Manasseh did when they were on the other side of Jordan? What did they do? Does anybody remember? They decided they liked, whenever they took over Ammon and Moab, they decided that this was well-watered area. It's good for our flocks. We're just going to settle over here. You guys can have the rest of the land on the other side. And so the rest of the nine and a half tribes, that was Ephraim, it was half of Manasseh and Gad, it was one more. Can't remember now. But they didn't cross over. They were happy to just stay on that side. Of course, they became, you know, they were the borderline tribes, and they were the first ones that were taken over by all of their enemies because they were separated from the people. There's a great lesson there. But in this case, whenever they first made that decision, we're not crossing over Jordan, we're just going to stay over here. Well, the rest of the tribes, they put on their swords. This is way back when they were first going into Canaan. And they said, well, you know, what do you mean you're not going to go over with us? We're all one people. They said, oh, no. That's not what we mean. We just mean we'll leave our flocks and our herds and our families here, and we will put on our swords and we will fight the battles of the Lord. And so we're going to go with you. Oh, let God curse us if we don't do it. So that's how they settled it way back when they first went in. Now, years have gone by, and the land has been settled. The law of God has been given. The people have become very wicked, and it's getting worse and worse and worse all the time. And when it came time to defend themselves against the kings of Babylon, Jabin and his commander, Sisera, and they were being run over by all these people, did Gad and Manasseh cross the river and help them? Nope. Just exactly what they knew was going to happen did happen. They were indifferent. They had promised that they would always be united with the people. You know, there's a lot of people like that today. And I'm talking in terms of real battle that went on at that time. But there are all kinds of reasons for the people of God to stick together today as well. There's every reason under the sun for us to be together in prayer and together in mission and together in we're supposed to be serving God together, but it's very difficult to keep Christians together. We want to divide up over everything. There was the indifferent. That was Gilead. And then there were the distracted people, the tribes that were distracted. It says Dan stayed on his ships. I can't tell you exactly what that means, except they were a very interesting tribe. Their allotment was in the south, but they didn't like it. It was too hard to conquer the Jebusites. So they went up to the north to a little town up north called Laish, and they went in there and killed everybody and took that location. Now they evidently are out in the Mediterranean Sea floating around in boats, and when it comes time to fight, they didn't want to fight. We got boats, we bought these boats and stuff, and we're busy with that. You know, we're not going to be able to come down and help. And then there was Asher. What did Asher do? All it says is they sat at the seashore. I guess they spent a day at the beach. You know, this war's going on, and they just, do you get the picture? In other words, these are the 12 tribes. These are the brothers that should have been together in good times and in bad. These are the ones that, you know, they should have been weeping with those that weeped, and they should have been, you know, rejoicing with those that rejoiced. But what were they doing? Well, they just all had their own thing. They were going their own way. They just did. And when it came time to stop this terrible scourge that was coming through the land, well, they just weren't united. Everybody had their reason. But there you go. You see this part. So you have then those people in the hour of struggle. Some carried all of the burden. Some didn't do anything at all. And then the next thing, verses 19 to 23, and I won't elaborate tremendously here except to say you have the undefeated hero, God. With God on their side, the ragtag army of Israel enjoyed overwhelming odds in the battle. It says specifically that they did not lose a single warrior. When we get to the other passage in chapter 4, which we're going to read in a minute, you're going to find out they did not lose one. Now, how many times do people go into battle and not lose a single soldier? And add to that the fact that they had no weapons. Now, you know, that would be quite a deal for the people of, you know, Deborah to send Barak out and say, you know, get everybody together. It's time to go attack Jabin and time to attack this Sisera and his armies and those 900 iron chariots. And so Barak says, OK, that sounds great. Now, what are we going to do for weapons? Because there was not a spear and there was not a shield, not one to be found in 40,000 soldiers. So God was calling them to go to battle without what? Wow. That's going to take a lot of faith. Maybe that's why Barak. Maybe that's why when we'll read the story in just a minute, why Barak didn't want to do it. He was a commander, but he didn't want to go into battle. So we have this undefeated hero, and he is God. He's on their side. And this ragtag army of Israel without any weapons, they still enjoyed overwhelming odds. In fact, they didn't lose a single soldier. And here's something I can always learn, and you can learn it. If I'm on God's side and God is on my side, I'm always on the winning side. Always. And that is just an absolute encouragement to everyone. Now, the seventh one, verses 24 to 27, comes to this lady that I am pointing to is a little known person who had a tremendous, tremendous impact in history. And I call her the blessed assassin. The blessed assassin, Jael. It's an interesting outcome to the story. God has been looking for his people to stand up for their own nation. He cursed those that refused to fight. Specifically, verse 23, curse Meroz. I mean, it's a city that's sort of midway down the land of Israel. Curse Meroz, said the angel of the Lord. Utterly curse its inhabitants because they did not come to the help of the Lord, to the help of the Lord against the warriors. So the call went out. It's time to do battle. It's time to come together. It's time to go up and stand up against the enemies of God. And so they were called to come and do that, and they just didn't bother at all. And boy, God sent the angel and says, curse that bunch. So it's interesting. God had been looking for his people to stand up for their own nation. He cursed those that refused to do it. And so what happened? A woman, not a man. A homemaker, not a warrior. A foreigner and not a Jewess was the instrument God used to eliminate the 5-star general of Jabin. Think about that. Praise is heaped upon her by the Jews, similar to the praise announced by Mary about Mary, the mother of Jesus. Look at it, if you would, verse number 24, chapter 5. Most blessed of women is Jael, the wife of Eber the Kenite. Most blessed is she among women. I mean, isn't it, blessed art thou among women? That's what they said of Mary, the mother of Jesus. Here you got this woman, and she's called blessed. Well, the Jews are praising her, because she has won a great victory for the entire nation, because she stood up. She had something in her heart that she was going to stand up against this Sisera. And we're going to find out what it was all about here in just a moment. Verses 28 to 30. I want you to get this. We're going to see the wicked mother of Sisera. What is she doing? Well, she looks out her window and she's lamenting because Sisera, her son, the general, the commander of Jabin's armies, who has 900 chariots and who always wins the battle and always brings home the booty, always brings home the spoils of war, he has not returned yet. And so she waits for her son to return, as she always had, and she can't understand the delay. Now, I want you to notice her callous, callous, callous heart. You say, well, what her heart and the heart of these other women. Now, let's read this again. Out of the window she looked and lamented, the mother of Sisera, through the lattice. Why does his chariot delay in coming? Why do the hoofbeats of his chariots tarry? She's wondering, where is he? He should be back by now. Her wise princesses would answer her. These are the maidens that are around her and princesses and others that are important people among the people of Canaan. Indeed, she repeats her words to herself. Are they not finding? Are they not dividing the spoil? A maiden, two maidens for every warrior. To Sisera, a spoil of dyed work, a spoil of dyed work embroidered. And he goes on to talk about the spoils of war. Now, I want you to listen to this for just a moment. You're going to get a little bit of the revelation of the Canaanite culture. Notice her callous heart, the revelation of how wicked the Canaanite culture were. Her and her women are looking forward to the spoils of war, and she specifically mentions for every man a maiden or two, a girl or two. Would you like to know what the literal word is in Hebrew? I don't mean to be gross or anything like this, but we're adults. I don't think there's any little children in here. It is literally for every warrior a womb or two. In other words, it is 100% a sexual conquest for these warriors. In other words, the reward of these warriors that was commonly received and expected, part of the spoils of war, kill all the men, bring all the young women back, and just have yourself a good time. And then make them be slaves, make them be servants, make them do all of those things, in addition to stealing everything that's out there and bringing home all the goods. You know, this mother of Sisera is not fighting the cause for women's dignity and value. She is not part of the Me Too movement. She just doesn't care. She just wants what she gets out of all of this. And her son, Sisera, she's wanting him to come home. And she is just right into this whole culture. I'll let you know a little bit about why God said it was going to be 400 years that the children of Israel, and I won't go and chase down all these passages, but it was going to be 400 years before God was going to deliver the children of Israel out of Egypt and take them back to Canaan, because he wanted the wickedness of the Canaanites to come to the full. In other words, the wickedness of these people was going to come to the full. And I've told you this before, Tyre and Sidon, those cities. Of course, we already know about what was going on at places like Sodom and Gomorrah even before the children of Israel ever went down into Egypt. Canaan was the center of cultic prostitution-oriented worship. Canaan was the place where religion and sexuality were mixed, blended, and the way to worship in Canaan was to break all of the societal norms and rules of every other nation. And God let Canaan get to the most wicked place that he could, and he told the children of Israel, go in there and do the world a favor, wipe these people off the face of the earth, spare no one. I had a person come to church one time that never came back, and he came up to me, and I was talking about the righteousness of God and how God is always righteous in his judgments, and how Joshua and how Caleb and how when they went into the land of Canaan, they were doing the world a favor. And he came up to me and he said to me, he says, man, and of course he's thinking in 21st century. He's trying to put everything in 21st century and all of the attitudes of tolerance and all these kind of things. And he comes up to me and says, I don't know why in the world you would say that Joshua and all of his people and all of those men, that they were heroes, because they went and committed genocide. They went and slaughtered all these people. They went and did these terrible things. I said, you're making that statement without any understanding of just who the Canaanites were and what was going on in Canaan. This is the center of Molech worship. This is the center of Chemosh worship. This is the center of burning your children in sacrifices to these false gods. This is the center of having temple prostitutes for every religion. All of the religions later, like Ephesus, where Diana or Artemis, all of those had their origin in Canaan. And when God chose to wipe out the peoples of Canaan, he was doing the world a favor. And when Israel did not obey him completely, the result, we're still living today. Think about that. So this is just one more evidence. This is one more person, just a single person that is giving you an evidence of what life was like in Canaan among those pagan people that were all around there that and what they wanted. Now, that's the celebration of the victory. Now, go back to chapter 4, and I want you to see the actual story and what happened. And let's pick it up now in verse number 4. Now, Deborah, a prophetess, the wife of Lapidoth, was judging Israel at that time. And she used to sit under a palm tree. I don't know why Deborah was a judge, why she was doing this job. But she was the wife of Lapidoth, and she was judging Israel at the time. And she used to sit under a palm tree, the palm tree of Deborah, between Ramah and Bethel. Very famous cities in Israel. In the hill country of Ephraim, and the sons of Israel came up to her for judgment. She would pass judgment, and she would give out, apply God's law to the people. Now, she sent and summoned Barak, the son of Abinoam from Kadesh Naphtali. So he was from Naphtali. And said to him, behold, the Lord, the God of Israel, has commanded, go and march to Mount Tabor and take with you 10,000 men from the sons of Naphtali and the sons of Zebulun. And I will draw out to you Sisera, the commander of Jabin's army, with his chariots and his many troops to the river Kishon. And that was the river that we found that God flooded with the rain that stopped their chariots and so on. Then Barak said to her, if you will go with me, then I will go. But if you will not go with me, I will not go. And she said, I will surely go with you. Nevertheless, the honor shall not be yours on the journey that you are about to take, for the Lord will sell Sisera into the hands of a woman. Then Deborah arose and went with Barak to Kadesh. So you get the idea that Deborah is going to, okay, if you're not going to do it, then I'll have to do it. You know, I'll go with you and I'll take care of this, you know. But that's not what happened. She was a prophetess. She was a judge. And so she's prophesying here. Barak, because you're not willing to obey the Lord yourself, because you're not believing in him yourself, because you're not doing what he's told you to do, then the honor of this victory is not going to be yours. It's going to be given to a woman. Wow. And so Barak called Zebulun and Naphtali together to Kadesh, and 10,000 men went up with him. Deborah also went up with him. Now, this is background information, very important. Now, Eber, the Kenite, had separated himself from the Kenites, from the sons of Hobab, the father-in-law of Moses. Another name, I believe Hobab was actually the son of Jethro, but in this passage they're calling him the father-in-law. The reference is to Jethro, the father-in-law of Moses, and Hobab. And he had pitched his tent as far away as the oak in Zaanim, which is near Kadesh. So you get the picture that the Kenites, who were historically friendly with the Israelites, the Kenites, Eber the Kenite, one of them had decided to leave. He didn't want anything, have anything to do with his Jewish friends anymore, nor with the rest of the Kenites. So they told Sisera that Barak, the son of Abinoam, had gone up to Mount Tabor. And Sisera called together all of his chariots, 900 iron chariots, and all the people who were with him from Harosheth Hagoyim to the river Kishon. And Deborah said to Barak, arise, for this is the day in which the Lord has given Sisera into your hands. Behold, the Lord has gone out before you. And so by then it's probably raining, and he starts to get the picture. Ah, those chariots can't do anything. So they went and snatched their armaments from them and killed them with them, basically. So Barak went down from Mount Tabor with 10,000 men following him, and the Lord routed Sisera. Notice verse 15. The Lord routed Sisera and all of his chariots and all of his army with the edge of the sword before Barak. And Sisera alighted from his chariot and fled away on foot. So he couldn't go anywhere in his chariot, so he's running. But Barak pursued the chariots and the army as far as Harosheth Hagoyim. That's where Sisera was from. And all the army of Sisera fell by the edge of the sword. Not even one was left. Boy, God knows how to get rid of the enemies. Now Sisera, the only one left, had fled away on foot to the tent of Jael, the wife of Eber the Kenite. Now watch these words. For there was peace between Jabin, king of Hazor, and the house of Eber the Kenite. Jael went out to meet Sisera. So let's get the picture again. Back up in verse number 11, Eber the Kenite had separated himself from the Kenites. Get that in your mind. They were historically friendly with the Jews, but he had become a traitor. And he'd gone over to Jabin and he made a pact with him. He said, I'm tired of the Kenites and I'm tired of these Jews. I'm making a pact with you. I'm joining up with you in all my house. And he told his wife, Jael, and keep your mouth shut. Just do what I tell you. So Sisera fled away on foot to the tent of Jael, the wife of Eber the Kenite, for there was peace between Jabin, the king of Hazor, and the house of Eber the Kenite. And Jael went out to meet Sisera. The woman comes out of the tent to meet Sisera and said to him, turn aside, my master, turn aside to me. Do not be afraid. And he turned aside into her, into the tent, and she covered him with a rug or perhaps a lambskin of some kind. And he said to her, please give me a little water to drink, for I'm thirsty. So she opened a bottle of milk and gave him a drink. And then she covered him. And he said to her, stand in the doorway of the tent, and it shall be if anyone comes and inquires of you and says, is there anyone here? You shall say, no. But Jael, Eber's wife, took a tent peg and seized a hammer in her hand and went secretly to him and drove the peg into his temple. And it went through into the ground, for he was sound asleep and exhausted. So he died. And behold, as Barak pursued Sisera, Jael came out to meet him and said, come, and I will show you the man whom you are seeking. Now watch. Barak, I mean, he's feeling vim, vigor, and vitality by now, you know, because they have completely routed all the rest of the army is dead. And somebody said Sisera took off running up that way by himself when he couldn't get his chariot moving. He took off running, and he's up, he's finished up, he's mopped up the rest of the army, and they've taken back all of their swords and all their spears and all their, and he's chasing him down, and he comes to the tent of Jael. And Jael comes out and says, I know who you're looking for. I know what you're wanting to do. You're wanting to be the one to kill this guy, but come on in, let me show you something. I will show you the man whom you are seeking. And he entered with her, and behold, Sisera was lying dead with a tent peg in his temple. Think about that. So God subdued on that day Jabin, the king of Canaan, before the sons of Israel, and the hand of the sons of Israel pressed heavier and heavier upon Jabin, the king of Canaan, until they had destroyed Jabin, king of Canaan. And then comes chapter 5, they sing this song, and they have a celebration, and they tell the story, and they make a ballad out of the story, and the hero of the story, of course, is God, but one of the instruments that God used was this woman, Jael, whose husband had become a traitor, but she still had it in her heart. She knew Sisera. She knew Jabin. She knew the Canaanites. She knew what they were going to do with all of the women if they had captured them. She knew that. So let me go give you a few things here. In this time of the judges, when people had abandoned the law of God and there was no king, the people, each person, did what seemed right to them in their own eyes. Now, we could read that in the very last verse of the book of Judges, and it says it several times throughout the book. I said this last Sunday that these people were autonomous. Autonomos. Auto means self, nomos law, a law unto themselves. Autonomous. They were autonomous, a law unto themselves. Now imagine the societal chaos when everybody just wants to do their own thing without regard to who else it hurts or what other problems it causes. Can you imagine a society where everybody just wants to do their own thing? Oh, excuse me. That's the society we live in. You know, I mean, that pretty much is the world that we live in. It's not, I want to do what is good for the people. I want to live my life in a way that is good for me, my family, and the rest of the people. And what is good for us as a community. No, no, no. It's just, you know, whatever I want to do. So we can imagine it because we're living it. Not so much, I don't mean Christians in general, but I mean society in general. Here's something else about this passage. Men were not leading, not taking responsibility for their families and for their nations. Two men are mentioned in the passage. One guy's name is Lapidoth. I bet you didn't know him, did you? That's the guy's name, Lapidoth. How would you like to be Lapidoth? So who are you, buddy? I'm Lapidoth. Well, I don't know what that means. Who are you? Oh, I'm Deborah's husband. Oh, yeah. Yeah. Okay. Now we got you located. We know who you are. In other words, who is he? He's Deborah's husband. He's Lapidos. He's the husband of Deborah. And then there's this other man, Barak. He's the reluctant leader of the army. Now, I know a lot of men, and I've met a lot of men in my life who have Lapidos syndrome. They are males. They can reproduce, but they are not men. We got a lot of that going on. Let me say a word about the present radical abortion issue that's going on. You say, what? How in the world are you going to bring that up in this passage? Well, you just let me talk to you for a minute. Do you know why? Do you know why a lot of the women today that are so fiery, rage-filled about this issue of abortion? It's because the men, first of all, are not men. Now listen to me. Let me finish this before you start throwing things at me. Men are not men. They don't expect their women to have virtue and to have character. They want the women to give them anything they want. And so the men want to be able to have sexual relations, and they want to be able to get up from that sexual relation no matter what the product or byproduct is. And they want to be able to just go, and they do. Is this not how we have ended up in America with generations of children without father? They don't know who the father is. They're just gone. You have single moms, and they're raising these children, and many times they raise them, and it's a life of poverty, or it's a life of hardship, because the man just is scot-free. He can go have his fun, do what he wants to. Now, they're not men, they're males. But do you know why women are becoming so adamant about abortion? It's because they want to be just as free to walk away from that behavior as the man is. They do not want somebody to tell them, well, men can go out and be promiscuous and walk away from it without any repercussions, but women, they can't. They've got to have that baby. They've got to take it. See, I'm tough on men in our society. I'm very tough on men because men have become despicable like dogs in heat. We do not have any character. We do not have any responsibility. Fathers, even sometimes good fathers, have not trained and taught their sons to respect young women and to respect them as almost something sacred and untouchable until they have a commitment and a covenant and a promise, and it's something that they're going to stick with for the rest of their lives. Men are not being taught this, and so the women are have been taken advantage of for generations and generations and generations, and the answer to it has become abortion, reproductive rights. Now, I'm not telling you that it's the right decision. I hate abortion. We have now aborted more babies than World War I and II killed. We've killed more in abortion clinics than died in World War I and World War II. So I'm not at all excusing the abortion. I'm just simply telling you why they are so rabid about the right to abort a baby now, even up to the point of delivering the baby and after. You don't think we're depraved? We are. Mankind, without God, without the Holy Spirit, we are vastly depraved. That's a little side note. I had to give you that. This is what's going on. And so, here we are where the men have set the example, and they don't demand purity of themselves. They don't demand purity of their women. And so this has been the byproduct of that. It's developed over years. It's gotten worse and worse. And so in this passage, we have women that are stepping forward. They're leading. They're taking the lead. They're doing what the men aren't doing. Barak, he was afraid. He didn't step forward. And so because he didn't obey God and didn't step forward in faith to fight this battle, God says, you're not going to get the honor. A woman's going to get it. And so Deborah gets honor. Lapidoth, who knows what he was doing, but Deborah gets the honor. And then we have Barak. He doesn't get the honor, but Jael gets the honor. She's the one that's remembered. And so somebody's going to say, well, what's wrong with women leading? Well, I want you to look in your Bible to Isaiah chapter 3. Isaiah chapter 3. What is wrong with women leading? I get asked this from time to time. Pastor, you're just not catching up with the culture. You're not in line with society. We ought to have women pastors in the church. We ought to have women elders in the church. That's just what we ought to do. I don't know what's wrong with you. Every once in a while, somebody will come and say that to me, you know. And, I've got several answers. First of all, as a pastor, you're supposed to be the husband of one wife. I mean, that's kind of hard to fulfill, you know, if you're not a male. So let me go on here. Isaiah chapter 3 and verse 10. Isaiah chapter 3 and verse 10. Isaiah began in chapter 1 talking about the people of Israel, the nation of Israel. He says the whole nation is sick. You're sick from, you're covered with sores and boils from the top of your head to the bottom of your feet. And he wasn't talking about real illness. He was talking about they were sin sick. They were so riddled with sin that he likened it unto a leprous body from the top of the head to the bottom of the feet. You're sin sick. There's nobody to heal you. You don't even know you're sick. And you're getting worse. So that was chapter 1. Now listen to chapter 3. Say to the righteous that it shall be well with them, for they shall eat the fruit of their doings. In other words, do right, obey the Lord, and you will be blessed. Woe to the wicked. It shall be ill with him, for the reward of his hand shall be given to him. And as for my people, children are their oppressor, and women rule over them, O my people. Those who lead you cause you to err, destroy the way of your paths. Now, folks, there are some very, very, very fine women who are very capable leaders, yet it should never be because men would not lead, would not behave, would not obey the Lord. It should never be that way. Now listen, to the children of Israel, he said, here's what's wrong with your society. Children are your oppressors. I have never lived at a time when children and young people are setting the agenda and dictating the household and telling mom and dad the way it's going to be like the day in which we're living right now. I'm going to tell you something. Grandparents teach your children, and you, if you're here and you have children, please do not get it in your mind that your number one job is to be your child's buddy or pal. Play with them, enjoy them, have fun with them, take them on vacations, but they need a parent. That's what they need. And grandparents, boy, if you ever have 2 seconds to give a word, if somebody says, if your son or daughter ever says to you, man, I don't know what to do with my kids, I'm just having, well, say, then jump right in and say, hey, you know what, love them, have a good fun time with them, make sure you bless them every way you can, but they need a parent. They don't need somebody over them letting them set the agenda, make all the decisions and cry their way to whatever they want on a continual basis and get everything they want if they cry loud enough. They need a parent because children, young people do not know. They haven't lived long enough to know what they need. They don't know what they don't know what's best. They cannot know. They're too young. They cannot know. They need parents who've lived it and can know and do know what's the right thing to do. Let them eat cake 3 times a day. Let them have cake for breakfast and let them have ice cream for lunch and let them have brownies for supper and do that for a month and see what you get. Well, if you don't let them do that in their food, why would we let them do that in everything else that they do? Now, I'm gonna pull an illustration out here that is heartrending. And I'm just going to give you an example. But this is a recent, tangible illustration. A little boy died outside of Marshalltown over a cell phone. How many of you heard the story? You know it's true. I'm not telling you anything. Well, how did a young boy, how old was the boy? I forgot. 13. How is it that a young boy has gotten to the place where mom and dad cannot tell him no. To the point he is ready to go out and endanger his life to fight against their authority. Do you not see what I'm talking about? Parents are the ones supposed to be in charge. And you know what was wrong with Israel? The children were their oppressors. The children were setting the agenda. Now, and then the next thing, the very next sentence is, and women are their leaders. Well, there's nothing wrong with women leading in certain things, but the problem is where are the men? Could I just say that about America today? Where are the men? Where are the men? It's just absolutely... That doesn't mean men are brutes and men are, you know, cavemen, come in with clubs and beat everybody around and kick everybody and, you know, yell and scream. No, no, no. That's not manhood. Manhood is responsibility. Manhood is duty. Manhood is loving. Manhood is being there. Man, there's just so many ways that I could talk about. But manhood is present and takes responsibility and takes the lead and shields his wife and kids and leads the way. And does not let the children set the agenda and does not let the wife bear the brunt. And, you know, I could just stop right here, but there's more in the passage. But isn't it true? Boy, you know, biblical, godly men, what has happened to us? Now, I'm preaching to the best men I know. I mean, I'm talking right now. But we got to communicate this somehow to the next generation. We got to communicate this to people. Because America's coming apart at the seams. Our nation's falling to pieces. Our families are coming to pieces. And a lot of it has to do with, where are the men? So when called to the battle, Barak wouldn't go without Deborah going with him. He wasn't hearing from God like Deborah was hearing from God. So he said, look, I'll take the prophetess with me. So Deborah prophesied and saying, look, I'm going to go, but God's going to deliver them. And Barak, you're not going to gain the victory. You're just going to have to sit back and watch somebody else, a woman. Here's some observations very quickly as we close. Number one, God is not limited by the failures of mankind. He's not limited. God is not limited. You see, God's plan cannot be stopped. The nation of Israel, the people of Israel could not be wiped away. Now, why is it that God is going to preserve the nation of Israel? We're really going to see this on Sunday. I mean, big time. But why is he going to preserve the nation and not let them pass away? What's the biggest reason? Because who has to come through Israel? Jesus. Jesus has to come through. The Messiah has to come through this nation in order for the Word of God. So God's plan cannot be stopped. He is going to establish His King. He is going to maintain the bloodline of Jesus Messiah. And He's going to get the glory. Next, God expects men to lead. That's chapter 4, verse 9. This is what God expects. Next, with God on our side, we are always in the majority. And so when God was fighting for them, when they obeyed, they did what they were supposed to do, they went out against this chariot, this group with 900 iron chariots when they didn't even have a sword or a spear. And they went out there and they were able to win that battle because with God on our side, we're in the majority. Next, God can use anyone He wants. Many times the person he uses is an indictment against the people who should be serving him. For instance, Eber was a Kenite, a descendant of Moses' father-in-law. For some reason, he had broken fellowship with the people of Israel and had made a pact or a covenant with the enemy, Jabin. The Kenites had been friendly with Israel ever since the time of Moses, but they never were Jews. But they were friendly and they had always worked with them. Then next, the weapons of God's enemies are worthless against him. The weapons of God's enemies are worthless against him. 900 iron chariots Sisera had at his command. And the Jews could not find a shield or a spear among 40,000. That was chapter 5, verse 8. Well, we just read these verses. Zechariah 4:6 says, not by might nor by power, but by my spirit, says the Lord of hosts. And how about Isaiah 54:17? No weapon formed against you shall prosper, and every tongue which rises against you in judgment, you shall condemn. This is the heritage of the servants of the Lord, and their righteousness is from me, says the Lord. Next, if we have a victory, if we do have a victory like they had a victory, it's because the Lord won the victory. The Lord won the victory. Next, just another observation. God always has his people. This is interesting to me. Jael, the wife of Heber, was prepared by God to get the glory instead of Barak. Barak was not going to be able to boast of killing the commander and having that honor, but Jael, a housewife, did it. You know, this story is repeated many times in the scripture. Do you guys remember the 7,000 prophets? You know, Elijah said, I'm the last one. God, just let me die. I'm the last one. There's nobody else. I mean, it's all over. All of the prophets have abandoned you. And the Lord told him, he says, will you just be quiet? He says, I've got 7,000 prophets, 7,000 men who have not bowed their knee to Baal. And I'm feeding them with a pagan king with bread and water. I'm keeping them alive. So God always has his people. Notice now some of these things about Jael. She used deception. She was calm and assuring on the outside as she met this guy. She was raging on the inside. Why do you think she was raging? Because she knew that this guy and his army, they had been doing this to women for years and years and years and years. And boy, you know, the guy's coming to her tent. Oh, yeah, sure, come in. I got something for you. She gave him milk. Why didn't you just give him water? What's milk? What does milk do when you wore out? It's like a sedative. Laid him down, covered him up with a big sheepskin. Just lay down there, big boy. Everything's going to be all right. I'll take care of you. She got him settled in. He falls asleep. And she says, I'm going to stop this right here and right now. Think about this. She knew what Sisera and Jabin did to women and to their victims. She risked her husband coming home and finding a man in her tent. She had fed him and comforted him and covered him with a blanket. What would Eber have thought? She could have been killed for allowing a man to come in her tent when her husband wasn't home. Think about that. She was merciless and vicious in this because they had been merciless and vicious to thousands through the years. This woman was not a warrior. It should have been a man to take him down, but she took a hammer and a tent peg, and while he slept, she slammed the peg through his head into the ground. She was used of God to shame Barak and all the men who were shirking their responsibilities. So Barak stands there and he looks at the one that he wanted to take down himself, and a woman has done it. God will get the victory. God will finish the task. God will also hold men accountable for what they allow to distract them from doing his will. God will hold men accountable for what they allow to distract them from doing his will. In our story, in this passage and narrative, we saw it told as a ballad, and we saw it told as actual history. And in both cases, what just stands out so hugely to me is that when men wouldn't stand up, women did. I cannot tell you how many times women have come to my office and said, I'm waiting on my husband to take the spiritual leadership of my home. I just wish my husband would. We come to church. He hears the same sermons I do. He reads the same Bible I do. He's heard it all. And I'm just waiting on him. And so finally, what does she do? Well, hubby's not going to get that Bible and share with the kids at home. And so what does the wife do? She picks it up and she does it. How many times does the good woman have to pick it up and do what a man is just not doing? Didn't used to be that way. It hasn't always been that way, not in our nation, but it just seems to be getting worse and worse. Well, the last thing I'll put on there, peace is gained at the cost of great commitment and great struggle. They wanted peace, and peace is not cheap, and peace doesn't come without effort. And, you know, we're blessed in our nation that we're still enjoying the peace that has been earned and preserved for us over a couple of hundred years by people who paid the ultimate price. And I just can't believe that they paid the ultimate price for the rest of us to just be irresponsible. I just don't believe that's right. So what do you think? What are your observations about this story? Tell me something. What do you think about it? Anybody? What strikes you about the story?
Careful, his tent, you go
Huh? Watch out which tent you show up at. Make sure it's yours. All right. Anybody else? What do you see here? Anything? What? Yeah. Yeah, I mean, she had great courage and she did it, but she did it and it was a shame. It was a shame to Barak and to the men and to her husband who had actually made an alliance with the enemy. You know, not even thinking about what all that enemy is doing.